actor at the scene here, so I'll be listened to on this. And I need to know, who set you out there tonight? She waited, boring in with her gaze. The uncanny. The rule of law as personified by a big black woman. Now that was uncanny. Also the most obvious and natural thing in the world. And inescapable. Inexorable. Extradition treaties with everywhere. She settled in and waited, feeling patience flooding her coterminously with her exhaustion right down to her sore feet. His frown turned to irritation. Like I said, we're working for the people who own this building, he said. So that would be the buildings managed by Morningside Realty. But they're just the broker. Who's the owner? The mayor? Hector Ramirez? Henry Vinson? Always nice to see that look of surprise on people's faces. 5 minutes ago, this guy had been thinking Jen was just a local cop. Now corrections and connections were going off in his head. Maybe he was recalling better the encounter with Jen on the boat downtown. She was citywide. She knew he had been working in Lower Manhattan. A mutual process of discovery here, that they both had larger briefs going in this town, and might therefore meet again, perhaps in a judicial venue. Jen gestured at the couches, sat back down. This time, the man sat down across from her. Not Vincent, he said. His partner before him. Now it was Jen's turn to be surprised. You mean Larry Jackman? The man nodded once, looking her in the eye. He was past his amazement, aware he'd shot through the narrows now and been carried out into deep waters. Might need Jen as a pseudo-ally somehow, somewhere. He had had his people stand down. He had answered questions when asked. No one had gotten killed out there by his people, hopefully. There was that to be said in his favor, such as it was. And it was not inconsiderable, either. She nodded encouragingly, meaning to indicate that he could actually get out of this free of consequences. The man said with careful precision, he put this building and some other assets in a blind trust when he started working for the government. He only communicates with Escher through third parties now, but we've been his security team all along. Jen was beginning to think that this night might not have been a complete fucking disaster after all, when the sound of gunfire erupted outside. Everyone in the room was suddenly back on point. Jen surveyed the lobby, the little militia she was in here with. I'm gonna say we pass on that, she said firmly. We're all staying in here. Whatever's going on out there can resolve without us. Really? The man said. Really? Tell you what? Defend the building. From inside. Defend it from who? Jen shrugged. Whatever. She took a look at her wrist pad, it having beeped. Ah, she said. Actually, it's the National Guard.
There is, in its enormity, a disproportion of effort. Too much energy, too much money. The fabulous machinery of skyscrapers, telephones, the press, all of that is used to produce wind and to chain men to a hard destiny, said Le Corbusier. In July 1931, a judge who was judging 22 hobos arrested for sleeping in Central Park gave them each $2 and sent them back to sleep in the park. At that time, there were shacks all over the park, all furnished with chairs and beds, 17 of them with chimneys. DeKalb Avenue was filled with celebrants. Cars were surrounded and trapped as if in a flood. A large black policeman waded into the street, gamely trying to get everyone to disperse so traffic could get through, when suddenly someone lunged at him and hugged him. The crowd converged on him. Suddenly, everyone was hugging him, a massive pileup of love. He started laughing. Tim Kreider, Election Night 2008, Brooklyn.
G. Amelia. The next day, July 8th, 2142, Amelia Black floated down the Hudson River Valley toward home. She had had a relatively good storm. Her tendency toward accident, as much innate as acquired, or thrust upon her, had thankfully spared her anything worse than being out on a flight when a hurricane was arriving. That had been stupid, sure, but she hadn't been paying attention, hadn't realized, etc. Once Vlade had alerted her to the situation, she and Franz had done the right things, all with her broadcasting the adventure to her audience in the cloud, which grew by the minute as people heard what she had gotten herself into this time. Amelia Earhart has done it again. Amelia Earhart is in big trouble. Amelia Blank is blanking again. Amelia Earhead might not be able to read a map. Ha ha, etc. But from the moment Vlade had alerted her to the danger, she had flown the assisted migration north as fast as it would go. And although this top speed was only 50 miles an hour in still air, with a growing tailwind pushing her, it had been enough to get her to the little town of Hudson, New York, which she called Hudson on the Hudson, where she was allowed to tie off on one of the blimp masts at the Marina Abramovich Institute, named after one of her heroes and role models. Once the airship was tied to that mast, its intense flailing became a natural piece of performance art, and at first, Amelia had resolved to stay in the gondola through the hurricane, tie herself into a chair, and get tossed around like a bull rider, like Marina herself doing one of her variously dangerous and awesome performances. She would be riding the storm, as she put it to her fans. But even with the spirit of their founder hovering over the Institute and encouraging Amelia to go for it, the actual curators of the place had insisted that given the forecast, in this instance, discretion was the better part of value, as they liked having Amelia there, but didn't want her getting thrashed to death, witnessed by millions in the cloud. Marina would have done it, they conceded, but insurance prices being what they were, not to mention boards of directors, donors, and the laws against endangering children and the mentally incapacitated, it was probably best that she not commit suicide by hurricane. "I am fully mentally capacitated," Amelia objected. "We're not sure the fabric of your blimp will sustain 160-mile-per-hour winds. Please don't abuse our hospitality." "It's an airship, by the way." So Amelia had, with some difficulty, gotten out of the gondola without getting crushed under it. And after that, watched Franz ride out the storm, narrating the spectacle from inside the Institute. Ironically, at the height of the storm, the Institute had had all its north windows sucked out in a single moment of extreme vacuum pull, so everyone inside had had to retreat, with a lot of shouting and even screaming, to the basement, while Franz and the assisted migration had negotiated the onslaughts with only a certain amount of deformative streamlining, being tied down by 8 stout lines to 8 strong anchoring points, also tied stoutly to a stout mast. Franz had worked hard to counteract the bouncing of the assisted migration by way of thousands of exquisitely timed counter-thrusts from the airship's various propellers. The airship still hit the ground repeatedly and then shot up and strained against the anchor lines, but both the smashes into the ground and the jerks against the anchor lines were constantly mitigated by Franz's micro-bursting on the props, finessing the impacts with impressive panache. So Amelia would have been safer in the gondola than in any building whatsoever. Another testament to the assisted migration. Also to the principle of flexibility, of soft power and adaptation. So superior to rigidity and hard power, as she pointed out while narrating the admittedly still very dramatic images of the assisted migration, shimmying like a shapeshifter under the storm's wicked slaps. "If only wind were colored so you could see it," she gushed at one point. "I wonder if we could set off some colored flares, or create a fog of some sort upwind of this place. It would be fantastic to be able to see the wind." This was agreed to be a good idea for some other storm. Wind as an aleatory art. It would be good. As it was, the invisible substance tore at the world with such force that it became somehow visible, or at least extremely present, as the abrupt defenestration of the Institute made clear with a palpable punctuation. Such cracks, such roaring, such screams of dismay. It was good material. But then again, so much of the storm was good in that regard. Amelia and her hosts weren't the only people in trouble, nor among those in the worst trouble. So she stayed in the cloud narrating the storm, but did not score exceptionally high viewing numbers, as the competition out there was intense. It was somewhat of a lost opportunity, but then again, she was going to survive, as was the assisted migration and Franz. Or so it seemed, until a shard of a newly shattered window flew into the airship and cut open several of its ballonets. After that, the wind had its way with what remained. Pop goes the weasel. So Franz was deflated and thrashed on the ground like a big carpet, and there were repairs to be made before Amelia could return to the air. But eventually, it got done by the ground crew of a nearby airfield, happy to get the famous Cloud Star back in the air, and themselves briefly in the cloud with her. That done, she flew back down to the city at about the 1,000-foot level, always excellent in terms of angle and prospect. What she saw along the way astounded her. The lower stretch of the Hudson Valley was stripped of its leaves. It almost looked like midwinter, except so many trees had been knocked to the ground, or, if still standing, were extending their amputated limbs to the sky. It was much more noticeable than the damage to buildings, which was mostly a matter of missing windows or torn roofs. That was bad. The reconstruction was going to take months, she could see. But the flattened trees would take years to regrow. And of course the animals that lived in the forest would be similarly stricken. "Wow," Amelia said to her viewers. "This is bad." Her voiceover on this day did not constitute her most eloquent performance. After a while, feeling overwhelmed, she mostly let Franz mention where they were and left it at that. As she came closer to the city, the cloister cluster reared up over the horizon long before anything else, a copse of spikes poking the sky. Well, the tower survived. She floated down the middle of the fjord, and when she was offshore from the uptown towers, she slowed a bit, so that they and the Hoboken towers were both displayed to greatest effect, looming well over her cruising altitude to each side. At that point, the Hudson looked somewhat like the flooded floor of a shattered, roofless room. It was creepy. Finally, she veered in toward the city to have a look down into Central Park. She was shocked, like everyone else, by the devastation. It was a tent city now, punctuated by hundreds of downed trees, the holes left by their roots giving it the look of a cemetery where all the dead had burst out and run off, leaving their open graves behind. People like ants everywhere, the lost ones of the city huddling there, mostly out of an instinct to huddle, it seemed to Amelia. Then she saw that there were people gathered on the plazas of Morningside Heights, around the black marks of dead bonfires. There were lines of people, too, regular enough to suggest they were military. Army in the streets. She wasn't sure what that meant. The whole city was a mess. "This is so sad," she said. "It's going to take years to fix all this." An automated radio message came in, telling her to stay out of the city's airspace. She had Franz circle Manhattan offshore, rising a bit as they did. There was a layer of puffy summer clouds drifting in from the west and over the city. The dramatic alternations of sunlight and cloud shadow made the long spine of Manhattan look like a piebald dragon, slain and lying dead in the bay. Amelia called home to tell Vlade she was going to make a circuit or two before coming in. He was with other people in the dining hall, she could hear. She said hi to them all. "It looks like the super scrapers uptown didn't sustain much damage," she said. "Do you know how they did?"
"We hear they're okay," Charlotte said. People charged them last night,
Vlade said.
Tried to get in them to get some shelter, but they were kept out.
But couldn't they be turned into temporary refugee shelters? It looks like they'd fit everybody in Central Park, more or less. Charlotte said,
That's what I was thinking, but the mayor won't do it.
Well, shit.
That's what I was thinking.
Hi, Amelia,
came the voice of Roberto. Roberto! Stefan, are you there too?
I'm here.
I'm so glad to hear your voices. What did you do in the storm?
We almost got eaten by muskrats,
Roberto said. No! I love muskrats!
We talked them out of it,
Stefan said.
Now we like them too.
Maybe we can do a study together. They'll be rebuilding, just like us. I can see that the storm surge got pretty high.
22 feet,
the boys shouted. A lot of the buildings are gone. How did our building do? Amelia asked.
Okay,
Vlade said.
The farm was wiped out, but the windows all held. This is one tough old building.
No farm? What will we eat?
Fish,
Vlade said.
Clams, oysters, and so on. We might be a charity case for a while.
That's not good.
Everybody will be. Not the people in the super scrapers,
Charlotte said. I don't like that, Amelia said. She told them she would let them know when she was coming in, then ended the call. She floated back north, hanging over the East River, looking down at the wreckage in the shallows of Harlem and Queens and the Bronx, then at the immense towers of the Cloister Cluster, metallic and colorful in the sun. Even though she had ascended to 2,500 feet, the tallest towers still overtopped her. The image of the boys' muskrats came to her. So many animals would certainly have drowned in a surge that high. In fact, at that very moment, she spotted a pile of animal bodies, piled like bonfire wood on the big north meadow of the park. Something turned in her as she realized what that little pile was, like a key turning in a lock, and she sat down hard on her pilot stool. After blindly staring down at the city for a long time, she couldn't have said how long, she tapped the buttons that got her back in the cloud and went live with her people around the world. Well, folks, you can see that those super scrapers came through the storm just fine. It's too bad they're mostly empty right now. I mean, they're residential towers, supposedly, but they were always too expensive for ordinary people to afford. They're like big granaries for holding money, basically. You have to imagine them all stuffed to the top with dollar bills. The richest people from all over the world own the apartments in those towers. They're an investment, or maybe a tax write-off. Diversify into real estate, as they say, while also having a place to visit whenever you happen to want to visit New York. A vacation place they might use for only a week or two every year. Depends what they like. They usually own about a dozen of these places around the world. Spread their holdings around. So, really, these towers are just assets. They're money. They're like big, tall, purple gold bars. They're everything except housing. As she was saying this, she turned the assisted migration around and headed south. Now, here below us in Central Park, it's a refugee camp now. You can see that. It's likely to be that for weeks and months to come. Maybe a year. People will be sleeping in the park. Lots of tents already, as you see. She looked into the bridge camera. So you know what? I'm sick of the rich. I just am. I'm sick of them running this whole planet for themselves. They're wrecking it. So I think we should take it back. And take care of it. And take care of each other as part of that. No more table scraps. You know that householders union that I was telling you about? I think it's time for everyone to join that union. And for that union to go on strike. In everybody's strike. I think there should be an everybody strike. Now, today. Her call line was lighting up, and she could see that Nicole wanted to talk to her. And her friends at the Met Tower wanted to talk to her, too. She thought she had better take the call from her friends, as she wasn't really sure what to say next. She paused her cloud feed and answered the call from the Met. Charlotte and Franklin and Vlade all said hi at once, sounding relieved she had answered. They also sounded surprised, and maybe a bit alarmed, that she had said what she had said. She cut them off. "Listen, guys, I'm going for it here. You can help me, or I can just wing it on my own, but I'm not going to back down. Because the time is now. Do you understand me? The time is now." She was getting upset, and she paused to collect herself. "I'm up here looking down at it. And I'm telling you, the time is now. So you'd better help me."
"We'll help you," Franklin said loudly over the clatter of their voices. "Put an earbud in and just keep going for it."
"Yay!" Amelia said.
"Really?"
Charlotte said.
"Why not?"
Franklin said.
"She may be right, and she's already done it. So listen, Amelia, just say it your way. And if you seem to be having trouble, pause and listen to the voices in your ear. And we'll feed you lines."
"Good," Amelia said. She put in an earbud and heard her friends arguing among themselves like little mice in her left ear. She unpaused her feed to her people and spoke again to the cloud. "What I mean by a householder strike is you just stop paying your rents and mortgages, maybe also your student loans and insurance payments. Any private debt you've taken on just to make you and your family safe. The daily necessities of existence. The union is declaring all those to be odious debts, like some kind of blackmail on us. And we're demanding they be renegotiated. So, we stop paying and call that the Jubilee? That's an old name for this kind of thing. After we start this Jubilee, until there's a restructuring that forgives a lot of our debt, we aren't paying anything. You might think that not paying your mortgage would get you in trouble. And it's true that if it was just you, that might happen. But when everyone does it, that makes it a strike. Civil disobedience. A revolution. So everyone needs to join in. Won't be that hard. Just don't pay your bills. What will happen then is that the absence of those payments of ours will cause the banks to crash fast. They take our payments and use them as collateral to borrow tons more, to fund their own gambling. And they are way, way, way overextended, overleveraged. I always wondered what that meant. It doesn't make sense as a word, but okay, never mind. The point is, when we stop funding their follies, they will crash real quick. At that point, they will be asking the government to bail them out. That's us. We're the government. At least in theory, but yeah, we are. So, we can decide what to do then. We will have to tell our government what to do at that point. If our government tries to back the banks instead of us, then we elect a different government. We pretend that democracy is real, and that will make it real. We elect a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That was the whole idea in the first place. As they used to tell us in school, and it's a good idea if we could make it real. It might never have been real up till now, but now's the time. Now's the time, people! Amelia took a deep breath, listened to the voices chattering desperately in her ear. Charlotte and Franklin in rapid counterpoint, having a little real-time editing war over what she should say. Amelia just repeated whatever sounded good to her in what she managed to catch of their discourse. Kind of a melange of the two of them. But so what? I know this all might sound radical, a little extreme. But we have to do something, right? or nothing will change. It will keep going on with them wrecking things. And this householder strike is the kind of revolution where they can't shoot you down in the public square. It's called fiscal noncompliance. It uses the power of money against money. In fact, it's a very neat trick if you ask me. You may be thinking that it's such a neat trick that it probably wasn't my idea. And that's true. I'm an airship pilot with an animal show in the cloud. Here I am, so yeah, still just Amelia Black. But I've seen the damage done. I look down on it all the time. I carry the animals away from it. And I'm looking down at it now. There's a pile of dead animals in the park. And I've talked with friends who've been working up this plan. And I think it's a good one. It's not just silly Amelia making another bonehead move. I mean, wait here just a second. Because at this point, it's democracy versus capitalism. We, the people, have to band together and take over. We can only do that by mass action. It's a case of all for one and one for all. If enough of us do it, they can't put us in jail. Because there will be too many of us. We'll have taken over. They've got the guns, but we've got the numbers. So, tell everyone you know about this, and feel free to share this show and its message, to forward it and all that. And anyone who stops payment on their odious debts and tells us about it immediately becomes a full member of the Householders Union. They're happy to have everyone join them, so do it. Send in your information. Membership is free right now. They might ask for union dues later. They'll fix your credit rating later. For now, they've got it covered. And it's definitely a case of the more the merrier. You know, I've noticed that everything that is really worth doing is always the more the merrier. Maybe not everything. What I hope we'll end up with is a big householders union, or a co-op, or whatever you want to call it. Used to be called government, and maybe it will be again. Once we get people in office who will actually work for the people rather than the banks. So, yeah, the more of you join in, the better our chances will be. So talk it over with your family and friends. Let's try it and see what happens. And if it doesn't work, you know, whatever. We can all talk it over in jail. If there's enough of us, maybe this whole island here will be the jail. So it won't be that different from the way things are now, right? Oh, hey, my friends are telling me that I should probably quit while I'm ahead. This is so often true. So, that's it for this episode of Assisted Migration with Amelia Black. See you next time.
On the ferry boats, the hundreds that cross, returning home, are more curious to me than you suppose. And you, that shall cross from shore to shore years hence, are more to me, and more in my meditations, than you might suppose. Others will enter the gates of the ferry, and cross from shore to shore. Others will watch the run of the flood tide. Others will see the shipping of Manhattan north and west, and the heights of Brooklyn to the south and east. Others will see the islands, large and small. 50 years hence, others will see them as they cross, the sun half an hour high. 100 years hence, or ever so many 100 years hence, others will see them, will enjoy the sunset, the pouring in of the flood tide, the falling back to the sea of the ebb tide. It avails not, time nor place. Distance avails not. I am with you. You men and women, of a generation, or ever so many generations hence. Just as you feel when you look on the river and sky, so I felt. Just as any of you is one of a living crowd, I was one of a crowd. just as you are refreshed by the gladness of the river and the bright flow, I was refreshed. Just as you stand and lean on the rail, yet hurry with the swift current, I stood, yet was hurried. Walt Whitman.
H. The City. Strategic defaulting. Class action suits, mass rallies, staying home from work, staying out of private transport systems, refusing consumer consumption beyond the necessities, withdrawing deposits, denouncing all forms of rent-seeking, ignoring mass media, withholding scheduled payments, fiscal non-compliance, loud public complaining. The interesting volume, Why Civil Resistance Works, makes the case that nonviolent civil resistance of various soft kinds is demonstrably more successful than violent resistance when it comes to actually achieving the stated goals of the resistance and changing things for the better. Chenoweth supposes this greater success for nonviolent resistance movements happens precisely because they are less violent, and therefore more likely to win agreement and compliance from the governments being opposed, and from the people whose welfare is supposedly in question. Seizing the state to achieve economic justice is seen as the principal success of these kinds of movements. General strikes and people massing in urban centers are usually understood to be the classic forms of civil resistance, but all the other methods listed above fit the definition and have been effective in the past. So, in the summer of 2142, people started doing all these things. The actors were many, as there was no cohesion or agreement on either means or ends. It began spontaneously soon after Hurricane Fyodor struck New York, when the emergency response to that catastrophe did not include the requisitioning of the empty residential towers of the city. This was the spark that lit the train of subsequent events. Riots in New York spread around the world at varying levels of intensity, depending on local circumstances, and in tough times it takes riots, Clover insists in Riot, Strike, Riot, to drive the point into capital's thick skull that a change is on its way and must occur, indeed is occurring. The coastlines naturally led the way in this rioting, being most stressed, but even in Denver, significant percentages of the population joined the various householders' unions and refused to pay rents of all kinds, mortgages and student loans especially. This form of resistance was expectedly popular. Purchase of non-essential consumer goods also dropped massively everywhere, crippling business growth by way of a perfectly legal fuck you. Which, after all, was merely a case of people not spending money they didn't have for things they didn't need. So, although there were only scattered mass demonstrations and occupations of city squares, and the results of the fiscal noncompliance were hard to see and report, there was a powerful sense of some underwater current in the global civilization now pulling it out into an unknown sea. History was happening. When that happens, you can feel it. The tug out to sea was naturally felt by the markets, as they are a sensitive instrument when it comes to noting volatility. One element that went into determining the IPPI was householder confidence, widely regarded as one of the fastest and most accurate indicators of housing price change. It had been considered impossible to rig or artificially shift householder confidence measures. Polling 5 million households was standard practice now, and so reported levels of confidence were seen as indicators that could not be manipulated, being so much larger than any manipulation could be. They showed a real thing. But the householders' union grew so big, so fast, that it influenced the behaviors of about 20% of all households, and the mood of a much greater percentage than that. So its calls for financial noncompliance could all by themselves torque the indexes. The IPPI numbers, therefore, fell sharply, and that dragged down the Case-Shiller numbers. And this caused the previous rapidly rising coastal housing price average to be regarded as a bubble. And that, all by itself, caused the bubble to burst in a classic "the emperor has no clothes" moment. That bubble's popping caused all of its derivative bubbles to pop too, which caused all banks and investment firms to call in all their liquid assets and stop loaning anything at all, even the standard interbank loans that kept the real economy going. Quickly, promptly, in fact, one of the largest investment firms collapsed and declared bankruptcy, and the fiscal relationships between all the big financial firms were now so tight that all of the biggest private banks in the United States and Europe then dashed to their central banks to demand immediate relief and salvation in the form of massive new infusions of money to ease their panic and keep the entire system from crashing. All this was reported. Everyone around the world was watching it unfold. Finance had once again frozen as confidence died and trust disappeared, and no one knew what paper out there was good anymore. No one knew what was money and what was dust. The house of cards had fallen again, and the whole world was left standing in the rubble of a crashed economy, looking again at the hapless people running finance and saying, just who the fuck are these guys anyway? Third time's a charm. Or fourth. Whichever. Past results being no guarantee of future performance.
Part 8. The Comedy of the Commons. Art is not truth. Art is a lie that enables us to realize the truth, said Picasso.
A. Mutt and Jeff. I don't like to see you wielding a hammer. It scares me.
You are easily scared. Why? What?
You are not a hammer kind of guy. I'm not sure who you will injure first, me or you.
Come on. It's not a complex skill. It's like typing. It's like typing with a big thing that whaps the keyboard for you. In fact, I'm thinking I may start typing with a hammer.
With two hammers, one for each hand.
Two for each hand, like a xylophone player. I will type like Lionel Hampton playing the xylophone.
Wasn't it a vibraphone?
Not sure. Hand me that bag of nails.
Mutt hands over the bag and contemplates his partner hefting hammer and nails. With the farm floor's tall arches so hugely open to the air, it looks like Bartleby the Scrivener has exchanged his quill for a riveting gun from the heroic age of high-rise construction. Although currently they are assembling long planter boxes. Eventually they will trundle hods of soil to these boxes rather than hods of cement. Otherwise, they're like Rosie the Riveter. Rosen the Riveter. Roosevelt the Riveter. Maybe that's where they got the name Rosie. Sure.
Or you could type with your forehead like Archie the Cockroach, Mutt says.
Toujours gay, my friend. I would enjoy that.
It was Mehitable the Cat who said toujours gay.
I know that. I'm the one who made you read that book.
I somewhat liked it, I have to admit.
I find that very encouraging.
It was funny to see how little New York changes through the centuries.
So true, if you disregard it being underwater and storm-racked.
As of course one should. Character remains despite one's circumstances, as Mehitable always said. It's a sunny day, some clouds over Jersey. Vlade appears out of the service elevator, pushing a wheelbarrow of black dirt. Idelba has been using her gear to salvage some of their farm soil from its resting place on the bottom of the canal between the Met and the North Building. A few more people unknown to Mutt and Jeff follow with more wheelbarrows. Jeff says,
"Here, this box is ready."
Vlade helps his team fill the new box with soil.
Idelba says she can pull up some good mud to mix with our compost.
We should be okay for soil.
You'll need seeds, Mutt points out.
Sure, but the seed bank is ready to provide. They want us to try out some new hybrids they've got. And some new heirlooms.
New heirlooms?
They rustled them up somewhere. The call has gone out. Anyway, we'll be okay. Back in business in time to get a late fall crop anyway.
What about our hotelo?
What, isn't that up yet? You can put that up in an hour. That's the point of those things. It's in the storage closet back of the elevators.
We didn't know where it was, Mutt confesses.
Sorry, I should have told you. Where are you staying now?
Nowhere.
In the common room.
Oh, hell. Let's get you up here. I need you here to serve as night watchman, and you need your place.
Vlade is as good as his word, so when the current load of dirt is shoveled into the new planter boxes, he goes to the storage room and pulls out what looks like an oversized suitcase. This, along with a trunk containing all their bathroom fixtures, is their hotelo, packed to move. All its parts are off the shelf, modular, easy to assemble. Plastic everything, including the air mattresses on cots, the walls that look like thick opaque shower curtains, because they are, the chem toilet, the light fixtures that are LED strings and often strung on the structural elements which resemble PVC tubing, now spangled as with Christmas lights, festive in the dark. Vlade takes a look around and declares the place rebuilt. It has indeed taken an hour.
It seems kind of breezy up here now, Jeff remarks to him.
It is always breezy up here.
But now I'm noticing it more, after the hurricane, I guess.
Sure, says Vlade. We feel it now.
What are you going to do about that, by the way? I mean, next time there's a big storm, in terms of protecting this floor.
I don't know. I'm still thinking it over. I think the whole city is, in terms of windows and how to deal. I don't know if there's any great solution if we're going to get storms like that one. I'm hoping that was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It's gonna take years to rebuild.
Mutt and Jeff nod.
Meanwhile, if you don't like living out here anymore, you should get on the list for a regular bed inside. Or maybe you can take Charlotte's room.
Her so-called room has walls thinner than ours.
Well, you might be able to be her room sitter if you want, if she wins this election and has to go to D.C.
Would she really do that?
I imagine she'd commute as much as possible, but I don't know. If you're in Congress, don't you have to be there sometimes?
Mutt and Jeff shrug.
I can't believe she wants to do it, Mutt says. I don't think she does. She's just mad right now.
Somebody's gotta do it, Jeff pontificates.
We can be her finance ministers without portfolio.
I want a portfolio.
Then you'd have to go with her to D.C.
Okay, not. But I always wanted a portfolio.
Well, she's going to need some finance advice, because the shit is hitting the fan.
It's working, Jeff says. I knew it would. It's like that Franklin says. The only problem is, if it works so well, it wipes out civilization. Aside from that, it's working fine.
Banks must be freaking.
Totally. The line between cash and not cash has abruptly moved, like only cash in hand is cash now, because people are definitely not paying their rents and mortgages.
And student loans? Mutt inquires.
They never paid those. So now there's nothing at the bottom of the house of cards. The dominoes are falling.
The falling dominoes are knocking over the house of cards?
Exactly. The whole shithouse is coming down.
Good. Then look, meanwhile we have our little home back.
I know. It's good.
Jeff stands in the open doorway of it, looking south at Wall Street.
If only everyone realized all you need is a hotelo.
Mutt moves past him and stops by the south railing.
The view helps.
It does. It's a nice view.
I love this city.
It's not bad. Especially from the 30th floor. Here, I'm going to build another planter box.
Watch your thumbs.
Mutt regards Jeff moving slabs of wood into position on a long work table.
You're a carpenter now, my friend. Have you noticed that we've gone from being coders to being farmers? It's like one of those dreadful back-to-the-land fantasies you kept giving me. Everyone goes Amish and all's right with the world. Unreadable horseshit, I'm sorry to say.
Jeff snorts as he lines up two slabs.
Hold this sucker in place while I nail it.
No way.
Jeff shrugs and tries to do it himself.
The idiocy of village life, isn't that what Marx called it? The idiocy of rural life, something like that?
And here we are.
Come on, I need a hand here. And we're at 23rd and Madison in New York City, on the 30th floor of a grand old skyscraper, so it's not as rural as you're saying.
And you like hammering nails.
I do, Jeff admits. It's like hitting the head of your worst enemy over and over, and you drive them right into a fucking block of wood. You can feel them go. It's very satisfying. So get over here and help hold this piece in place.
We call it a vice, my friend. Two vices and you're set.
Two vices don't make a virtue. Come hold this.
Hold it yourself. Practice your William Morris craft skills, your Emersonian self-reliance.
Fuck self-reliance. Emerson was a fool.
You're the one who made me read him, objects Mutt.
He's a holy fool, and you should read him, but he couldn't string two thoughts together if his life depended on it.
He's the greatest fortune cookie writer in American literature, Jeff snorts with amusement.
Self-reliance, my ass. We're fucking monkeys. It's always about teamwork.
That would make three very good fortune cookies. Maybe we could start a company.
Teamwork, baby. You do the work and I'll join the team. Come hold this slab of wood here.
All right, already. But then you owe me.
A dime.
A dollar.
A call option on $10 zillion.
Deal.
In this situation, what one can say, as Giambattista Vico seems to have been one of the first to do, is that while nature is meaningless, history has a meaning. Even if there is no meaning, the project and the future produce it, on the individual as well as the collective basis. The great collective project has a meaning, and it is that of utopia. But the problem of utopia, of collective meaning, is to find an individual meaning. Frederick Jameson, An American Utopia.
B. Stefan and Roberto. It took about a week for Stefan and Roberto to eat their way back to weight. And after that, Roberto got restless and began to plot their next move. Whatever this project turned out to be, it was going to be complicated by the fact that now they had about a dozen adults in the Met paying attention to them, and bringing up the foster parent thing, the guardian thing, the paper thing, the gold thing, trying to make them wards of the co-op, as Charlotte put it at one point when they refused all supervision. Neither of them liked any of these ideas, and they agreed it was getting dangerous to speak openly to anyone but Mr. Hexter, who had his own ideas about what they should do, and described himself as being, in relation to them, avuncular, meaning uncle-like in Latin. Seemed to them that it must be a cool language to have a specific word for being uncle-like, as uncles were nothing as far as they could tell. They were happy to let him take on the role on that basis. He was still trying to teach them to read. It wasn't much harder than understanding his maps. Maps were great. They were pictures of places from a bird's-eye view, easy to comprehend. Mr. Hexter wanted Amelia Black to give them a ride, so that they would be able to see how much the land looked like the map of it when you were up at the bird's level. They were agreeable to that. In fact, it sounded great. But even without that, the principle of maps was obvious, and they got it. And it had been the same with written words, which were like pictures of the spoken words, in that each letter was the picture of one or two sounds, and once you had memorized those, you could sound out any word and know what you were reading. That, too, had been easy. It had turned out to be way easier than they had thought it was going to be. It would have been even easier if English spelling were less stupid, but whatever. I wonder if all of school would have been this easy, Stefan said. You can still find out, Mr. Hexter said. But I don't recommend it. You guys are too quick for school. You might die of boredom and get in trouble, and you're already in enough trouble as it is. What do you mean? We're not in trouble. But it was true that Franklin and Vlade and Charlotte had melted their gold coins and were taking care of the money the gold had been bought for. And Franklin, in particular, was insistent that from now on, when they went out to do things, they had to take their wrist pad with them always, no exceptions. In fact, he said, I think that the idea of locking ankle beepers on you like they do with people under house arrest is a good idea. I bet Inspector Jen would bring home a couple for us. That way you wouldn't accidentally forget and go out and get yourself killed without us knowing how you did it. No to that, Roberto said. We are free citizens of the Republic. You have no idea whether you are or not. No birth certificates, right? No last names, for God's sake. In fact, Roberto, how did you get any name at all, being orphaned at birth and self-raised from out of a lobster trap? Roberto got his stubborn look. I am Roberto New York of the House of New York, The dock master called me Little Robber, so I figured my name was Robber. And then later a guy told me about Roberto Clemente, so I decided I was Roberto.
And you were how old at this point?
I was 3 years old.
Franklin shook his head. Remarkable. And you, Stefan?
I am Stefan Melville de Madison.
You're wards of the building. Or maybe lay mass. Charlotte made that your legal status. So if you want to go out, at least take that wrist pad.
All right already, Stefan conceded. We can always zap it later, he explained to Roberto, forestalling Roberto's expostulations.
For now, I'll go out with them, Mr. Hexter said. We're going to go out and see how things are looking since the storm.
We're going to go muskrat hunting!
Franklin nodded at this. Good. Mr. Hexter will be your electronic bracelet.
I am indeed powerfully attached to my friends, the old man said, shaking his head as if it were a bad habit.
Besides, what about our gold? Roberto demanded. Here you are trying to lock us down and you're keeping our own gold away from us.
No, no, Franklin said. Your gold is yours. What's left of it, anyway. We've got it in Vlade's safe so you don't make a big necklace out of it and then go swimming while you're wearing it. It's doing fine. More than fine. You know that. The Indian Central Bank loves you. And I used some of what they paid you to short housing. So now you are rich. By the time I'm done, you'll be about 50 times richer than you were with the gold. The only remaining question is whether anyone will be left standing to pay you.
Cool.
I want a gold doubloon to pierce and put around my neck on a necklace.
I think they're guineas, and haven't you heard those stories of guys getting beheaded by thieves going after their gold necklaces?
No.
The boys looked a little thoughtful at this.
Does that really happen?
Sure. This is New York, remember?
Okay, well, I still want one of the coins for in my pocket.
That seems fair. As long as you're wrist padded so we can recover your body.
Deal.
Then it was back to singing A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, etc. At this point, they sang it whenever they wanted to drive Mr. Hexter to something more interesting than reading. Today, with Franklin Garr off to join the Cloister Clusterfuck, as he called it, they used the song to convince Mr. H to agree to a cruise around the city. Their boat was no worse for wear, and they puttered about the canals of the neighborhood checking things out. The hurricane had ripped off all the leaves, so the terraces and rooftops looked bare, and many a canal was still clogged with debris. But they were able to get through most of them, and city crews were out in force working on the cleanup. There was a dank, vegetable, jungly smell in the air, and many people on the water were wearing white face masks. Mr. Hexter snorted at this.
Little do they know they're depriving themselves of needed nutrients and helpful microbiome teammates.
They found that the most common arboreal survivors of the wind's onslaught had been potted trees, which had presumably been knocked on their sides and remained prone through the storm, and now only had to be lifted upright to restore some green to the scene. They looked battered, but unbowed. They were like the city itself, Mr. Hexter declared. Up in the intertidal, things were truly squalid. Around 50th, the high water mark of the storm surge was obvious, an irregular wall of junk steaming in the criminal humidity. Mr. Hexter said it looked like the barricades of Les Miserables, windows intact in their frames, shutters, chairs, boat holes, trash cans, pallets, boxes, cans, and many branches, or even trees entire, roots and all. This long barrier reef complicated getting from lower Manhattan onto dry land, and it was interesting to see the city workers concentrate on certain avenue canals to establish functioning floater docks, 10th, 6th, 5th, Lex. Everywhere people were out and about, either looking for things or just living their summer lives. Refugee residents, hanging out all ragged. It was like everyone had been turned into Huck and Pap, or like the whole city had turned into the Street of Fundy on a fast ebb.
Why didn't they take over the uptown towers?
Stefan asked the old man.
They tried, and it didn't work.
So what? Roberto said. That was only one night. What if they kept trying every day? It doesn't occur to them. Why not? They call it hegemony. Not another word! Hexter laughed at that. Yes, another word. The war of words. Greek in this case, I think. Hedge money? Like Franklin Gar? No. Hegemony. Means the agreement of people to being dominated, without guns having to be pointed in your face all the time. Even if you're treated badly. You just go along with it. But that's stupid. Well, we're social animals, I guess you'd have to say. So we're all stupid, you're saying? We're like zombies! Hexter laughed. That's how I always used to think of it. Did you ever see Vampires versus Zombies? No, you didn't. A very great movie. The vampires fly around sucking the blood of working people. That's the best blood to suck. When the workers are drained, they turn into zombies. So the vampires fly somewhere else and drop in on a new population, leaving behind the zombies, who stagger around dead at that point. So that would be hegemony, Roberto said carefully. You are so good. So yeah, more and more people get their blood sucked and turn into zombies. And then when they're almost all zombies, all but one, all but two. Right, you two. But then the zombies decide it's time to revolt. About time. Better late than never. Exactly. So the zombies all slouch off toward the vampire castle, determined to invade. But they're very slow. At first, the vampires just laugh. But there's no new blood for them to suck either. So the vampires are slowing down, too. Eventually, the whole movie is in slow motion. It's hilarious. The zombies keep falling apart when they hit somebody, and the vampires can only bite. They're pretty weak on both sides. As usual, the scene goes on too long. But finally, the zombies just kind of crush the vampires under the weight of their detached limbs. The end. I want to see that. Me too. Me too, Hexter said. As they motored about, they kept an eye peeled for wildlife, muskrats in particular, but anything would do. Hexter said, the Indians figured that bears were the big brothers of beavers, and beavers were the big brothers of muskrats. The bigger ones protected the littler ones, I guess. But the bigger ones never ate the littler ones. What about otters? Oh, no. Otters are vicious killers. Playful, but vicious. It's hard to understand how they could kill anything. Their mouths are so small. It's a matter of attitude, I guess. Hey, look, there's a nest up on that cornice. Peregrine falcon, it looks like. They're so cool. They drop like rocks. Like arrows shot down. I know. So this is as close to a swamp as we've got now. This part of the intertidal at 55th and Madison. That's because it was a swamp, back before the city was here. This was the kill of Shepmoes, I think. I called it the Two Stooges Swamp. Now it's kind of come back. You see those willows and alders growing right out of the ground? And the old spring is back to springing. No way. Way. It never stopped. It drains the southeast corner of Central Park. It's the old watershed coming back. Which is what gives the beavers in Central Park their chance. Same up at the northeast end of the park. The beavers chew down the alder and willows with their teeth. That's right. They are way tougher than vampires, dentally speaking. They chew down entire trees and weave the trees and branches together until they have a beaver dam, which raises the water some and slows it down. Then they can build beaver lodges, where you swim up under them to get inside, and when you go high enough inside them, it's dry. That's very cool. It is. And it also makes homes for muskrats, who move into abandoned beaver lodges, or make their own using old beaver cuttings, mostly. So along with beaver, you get all the kinds of animals and plants that used